This podcast is in no way affiliated with the upcoming production or Deborah Harkness. All views expressed are solely our own.
It begins with absence and desire. It begins with blood and fear. It begins with the discovery of witches.
Welcome to episode 46 of the All Souls Podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer.
Welcome back, everybody. We've been on hiatus since the end of season two, which just ended.
Don't they call it a withdrawal?
It is. It has been withdrawal, yes. And we've been on withdrawal / hiatus, witch drought, whatever, since the end of season two, which was like late February, early March of 2021. We are now recording this discussion of episode 301, episode one of season three of Discovery of Witches in very late December.
Yeah, there was a much longer break between season one and season two.
Heck to the yes.
But I mean, that was all it had to be because, you know, Teresa was pregnant.
As fans, we're totally excited. As podcasters, it's a doozy, but we will do our best. So, as I said, episode 46, we'll be discussing episode 46, we'll be discussing season three of A Discovery of Witches, episode one. So, what I normally haven't done was usually on the recaps, I don't really mention them. I think it's not telling us anything we didn't already know. But for this one, I did take just very, very brief notes because it has been a season. It's been about 9 or 10 months for us anyway. So the episode one, at least the cut that we got, opens up with memories for us of season two, right? Diana's blood vow from Philippe.
It was just a recap.
Exactly. But it's not a recap of the whole season. It's very specific things.
No, but it's the recap to get you caught up on the major plot points of the previous season.
Yes, but I would argue very specific plot points or things that happened so that you are ready for this episode specifically. So Diana's blood vow from Philippe, her meeting Benjamin, who also recognized the blood vow on her, the blood rage vampire on the loose in London, 20th century, the 20th century congregation happenings, the half witch, half demon baby.
I mean, it's all witch.
Oh, sorry.
That's the problem.
No, sorry. Yeah, see, I was talking about the parents. So but the parents are both
demons.
Okay, sorry. See?
She's a demon born of witches, and he's just a demon born of demons.
Got it. So the baby of Nathaniel and Sophie, right?
Yes.
Two demons who is a witch as well, or also, yes. And then Owen's killing of Aunt Em. So it moves pretty quickly. And then we get into the opening scene. It was a they move real quick and like a lot of Outlander and like a lot of season two of A Discovery of Witches because of the time period. It's real dark. And I don't mean the topic. I mean
the screen.
Yes. It's like I was on max brightness and it was still very dark. But the very opening scene after the recap or the review, whatever, it was like the camera moved over a misty scene of the temple and then went straight inside to set tour. So it was real quick. It wasn't so quick that you probably missed it, but it was so dark and misty. You may or may not have known it was the temple unless you were like up close to your screen like I was. But anyhoozle, I think it was pretty easy to tell that it was the temple.
Well, I just want to say that it looks like our boy Rob Lane wrote another original song.
Yes.
To the tune of the main theme.
Yep. So after we go from the temple, again, the camera moves real quick. We're in set tour and the morning begins. We know it already began, but it begins. As I said, it's a very dark episode in topic, yes, but also in visual stuff.
In actual content.
Yes. Matthew and Diana return in their jammies from the 16th century to find Aunt Em lying on literally her deathbed. Sarah next to her. And again, Diana notices, like, she's like, what the heck? And she notices she's not well. And then we have a flash over to Marcus. Marcus also isn't seemingly well, or he's shocked, or he's probably more shocked than actually damaged. And we see Sophie is there with him. So she has come. And then I wrote exactly what Summer said. Note that the opening music is the theme, meaning the song they have. And it does sound like an original song. And it sounds like the same singer as well. He put words to the theme music. And I thought, that is awesome because we haven't had that yet. We have not had that yet. So we'll definitely have to chat with him about that. So we get a clip of Agatha and Nathaniel and the music, which has been going on. I think now we're back at instrumental. It turns major for a moment. And then we're back in the room with M. I couldn't tell or didn't see. Maybe it was too dark. I don't know. I couldn't tell. Okay. Did I know she was going to die? Yes. Did I think she was already dead at the end of last season? Yes. Did I know she was alive at the beginning of this season? No. I didn't know what to think when I saw her in the bed. I couldn't tell her eyes were open or not. So I didn't know. I thought, is it like, you know how they have people like they lay in state for a bit? I don't know. Lie in state. So yes. When we get up closer to her and we see her eyes are open, we don't know what she's felt. Like, we don't know. Is she in shock or is she literally in pain, dying? I mean, she may be she had pain, I'm sure, at some point or somehow. But in the books, we are led to believe, and maybe this was a change, we'll have to ask around,
that they found her dead at the temple.
Yes. So this actually is worse because she lasted longer, which is good that she got to be with her loved ones as she died. However, and it's more bittersweet, right? Because Diana literally walks, Diana and Matthew, but it's Diana's family. Let's be honest. They walk into the room as she's dying, and then we can only guess how much M was aware of. I think M was probably aware of Sarah because she had been there probably for a little bit. But right as the sun, it was very, very symbolic, right? Also, right as the sun was rising, she passes and she is surrounded by her family, her two most important family members. So, yeah, I am wondering what people are going to think about that. How do you feel about that?
I know the books and the shows are different things. I'm not conflating the two, but I did think it was a strange thing because if she had been alive when she was in the bed, wouldn't they have been like trying to like witchy mind meld, you know, like try to get in there and see, ask her the questions she wants to ask while she's alive, but maybe trapped inside of her head. I don't know. I just think having her be in a state where she could potentially still be communicated with.
Conscious.
Yeah, conscious, communicated with, made it feel like they didn't do enough or something like that. It was like, it's not that they didn't have a choice. It's that they didn't do anything. So I don't know if that meant that Sarah didn't have any witchy powers that would have allowed her to communicate with the consciousness of M if she was still in there or what. But I'm just thinking, if they had the opportunity to have a little bit of her alive in the book, then they, you know, I think the trajectory could have changed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I don't know what to make of that. Obviously, it is a purposeful choice, but I think it does. I guess it does two things and probably more. The two major things that it does in my mind is it gives Diana, I mean, I don't know that she said the worst goodbye, but at least gives Diana one last chance to see her, whether or not M knew she was there, right? It does give her that, even though it's obviously terrible. But I think that's slightly better. Nothing is good, but it's better than her coming up.
They don't come back through time the night that she's killed. You know what I mean?
No. When she comes back, she's already buried or has already had whatever ceremony is done to dead witches. So that's what I'm saying. It does two things that jump out at me. Number one, it gives her the chance to, I don't even know what to say, is, I don't even.
To do those things that
I
we
don't
didn't see in the book?
You can say even, gives her a chance to say goodbye, because I don't know that they got a chance to say goodbye. She got a chance to say goodbye. It does give her a chance to see her.
Do you think it gives the audience a chance to see the goodbye? To see what witches' traditions are?
I think that's a third thing. And like I said, there's a million things that I know this is done. The second thing I think that jumps out at me is what you said. So number one, it gives Diana an opportunity, and Matthew, but Diana an opportunity to see her. Whether or not M is aware of that or benefits from that, we have no idea. Or maybe we'll find out, but I don't know. But at least for Diana's benefit, it's not better than attending a funeral, but at least she sees her like for a snapshot before she's gone. I mean, it's not great. Neither of them are great. The second thing that it does is, like you said, it allows for a space of wonder of, yeah, like at least after one episode, we don't know what was done. We don't know if she was communicative. Sarah may have done a Jedi mind thing with her to try and find. We don't know. I don't know. I kind of doubt it. And it's not really that important now because obviously the episode moves on quickly and we're already in London and all these places and we're already setting up you know, to on the hunt for Benjamin, right? So I don't know that we would ever go back and be able to explore that. I don't think it's that important, but I think it gives just enough room for doubt. We don't know. We don't know what M saw, meaning if M saw Diana, we don't know if she could have been blinded for all we know, right? And we also don't know what Sarah did or didn't do. We don't know how long she'd been in that bed. She could have literally gotten there 5 minutes before Diana arrived. We don't know.
Agreed.
And then we have the next scene, which is short and sweet. Well, not sweet.
I didn't expect them to like out them this quickly.
No, there was. I think, again, they're trying to move, which I get.
No, it was like the immediate thing. It was like, okay, M's dead. That's sad. Oh, BT Debs.
Yeah, exactly. So she's there. Diana is in her room, in a room, mourning her aunt. Matthew comes in to join her and says, I love you, by the way, it's twins. And she's like, huh?
Pretty much.
And then something that did surprise me, maybe I shouldn't have been, but again, if we had 4, 5, 6 seasons, it wouldn't surprise me on subsequent seasons. But since this is our first subsequent season to season 2, and our only one, as far as we know, I was a little bit surprised at the Pyrex opening. They kept it. So they didn't change hardly. I know some of the images were different. The beginning was very similar. Like there was no more tree, right? There was no more the thing I called a tree. No, but they kept the same gist of at least the beginning of it. They started with but they kept the Pyrex opening, which I was surprised at. Well, not because it was good
is just to show that the science is just as important as the mystical stuff.
I wonder if they kept it because it worked. They changed between one and two.
But you know what, though? Let's be honest. Most series,
I agree,
in their first season have one opening. In the second season, they put more stuff, some stuff from the season that they're going to watch and some stuff from the seasons that they just watched. So when you get to the third season, they just kind of did that more. They did the highlights of last year's and the new stuff they wanted to sprinkle in from this
That's
year.
What I'm saying. It doesn't surprise me that they did it because their move openings from between 1 and 2 is night and day. It's a 180 shift. Between 2 and 3, it's identical in format. The content is slightly different, right? Because they bring in different images, different video. But like, I'm just wondering why the choice was made. We have to ask the right person. We have to ask the right questions. We have to ask what was involved in the decision. Was it budget? Who knows? What was involved in the decision to change, to make that drastic? We all love it. There's nothing bad about it. It's a wonderful change. To make that drastic change between 1 and 2 opening, and then therefore, why not change it again between 2 and 3? I think it makes sense not to change it, right? I think it makes sense to keep it and only put in the little bits of the season or upcoming episodes. It's not an issue. I was surprised. So now that I said Pyrex opening all throughout season 2, and I've got it out here in episode 1 of season 3, I'll try not to say Pyrex, but I don't necessarily go through like we have done on Outlander, right? I don't necessarily go through and try to break things down too much. If I notice something kind of standing out, I might go, oh, did you notice the blah, blah, blah? More likely I'll miss it. But since it's now being basically repeated, the format from season 2, it's not I think we can expect it to either the rest of the season. So I don't know that I need to mention Pyrex opening. So then all the fam dam. The fam dam starts to come. So we've got Hamish and then Galaglass, all bearded. Do you prefer Galaglass with or without a beard? Or I should say, not Galaglass, Stephen Cree.
I mean, to be honest, I was just happy that we got Galaglass this quickly because I was...
Right?
I wanted to be like... I was thinking, leading up to us being able to watch the episode, of like, what does future Galaglass look like? Does he still have a page boy?
Oh, summer.
Does he still have his luscious locks? What is he going to look like? So when he showed up and I was like, yeah, I can get down on that.
Wait, get down with that or get down on that?
Yes.
Okay, that's what I thought I heard. So he's bearded. The light is suddenly, I'm not saying it's him, it's not him, and it's not the same scene. But once he arrived and they go into the next scene, it just happens to be in the room where they're all at. It's a day room, or looks like it could be a meeting room or a salon or something, but they're all around the table. But it's so bright. We can actually see.
I said, but knowing about Galaglass, did you notice him in the hug?
Oh, with when he greeted Diana?
Uh-huh.
When he just kind of held her?
Yeah, but his face and his whole body when he went to touch her was like happy, sad, Like, it was all of the emotions. Like, it wasn't just a, hey, welcome back. It's a hug. Like,
I hope they give us all this.
The hug looked more than a hug from him. Whereas with her, it looked like a hug.
Yeah. Well, on her side, it was a hug. That's all I can say.
That's right. Because only 2 days ago.
Exactly. I hope they give us that. I think they will. But I'm not sure exactly when it was let out. But I hope they give us that. I mean, in the books, I'm not sure exactly when it was let out. So
the last book.
Where in the book? Early on, later on? I don't know. They're in this room and it's just so much brighter. Everyone is gathered to discuss Peter Knox's murder of Emily. They need to decide what to do. Do they kill him or not? The danger of killing him is that he might become a martyr, which does not help them. Agatha, also Demon Supreme, Queen Demon Supreme, is on her way to the congregation to try to beat Knox to the punch, meaning get ahead of the story before anyone finds out about M, let alone the fact that Knox did it. And back with the fam, Fan Damley. I'm not doing very well at that. So they tell Matthew about. I'm really not doing well at this.
Wow.
So they tell Matthew about blood rage vamp attacks in London. And so they're talking about what they can or can't or should or shouldn't do with Knox. And they're bringing him up to speed on all the stuff that's gone down in London while he's been gone. And they're connecting it, or they're bringing it all together and say, look, Gerbert, do not get this wrong. Gerbert will use any of this and all of this against you and against us. Then, next scene. So then Matthew's by himself and Phoebe goes in to meet Matthew, introduce herself. And he's like, I know who you are, Phoebe. And then Marcus joins her and he gets after Marcus as the Grand Master of the Knights of Lazarus. He's like, how can you have let him get anywhere near Setur? And there's still beef between them, not just about this one, you know, about M, but there's still beef between them because Matthew, as we found out in season 1, Matthew never told Marcus about the blood rage. And so Matthew had reasons, which we understand, but Marcus is kind of not necessarily trying to hold it over him, but Marcus is like, look, it's not just everybody else's shit who stinks. Your shit stinks too, okay?
No, he's deflecting his anger by telling him what a disappointment he is.
All of that. Exactly. I'm going to deflect over here. It's like, look, you can't deflect the fact that your shit stinks. It all does.
Exactly.
Back at the temple, Sarah is with Diana, and the missing page reappears magically. Sarah tells Diana about M, about what kind of went down the page and how she obviously was protecting it from Knox, and that she had wanted to contact Rebecca going to the temple. That's why she ended up going there. And then Sarah, I am summarizing this a lot. We can break it out more if you want. Then Sarah, in a moment of desperation with Diana, says they could ask M what was up with the page, like what was going on and what did you find from Rebecca, etc.
Before she continues, what did you first assume she was asking her to do?
What did I think Sarah was going to ask Diana about?
From what Sarah stated, what did you think she was asking Diana to do?
That's what I just said. What did Sarah want Diana to do?
Because I was confused as f- because I was listening to it and all I heard was, you know, what we can do, you know, we can ask her. And I thought she was going to ask her to try to do the higher magics.
Yeah.
I'd completely forgotten about the time traveling part of it. So for her to have jumped immediately to time travel, I was like, oh, is that what we're talking about?
I'm glad you said that because I did not take notes on that. So I watched this twice. Once, as I always say, once as a fan to enjoy and then once to take once to take notes. Yes. When I watched it as a fan, I straight up thought it was about let's do darker or let's do higher magic.
Right.
And then on the rewatch, I think I had to rewind it a few times. I wrote something and then I was like, oh, I think she means time travel. Because I started thinking, wait, when would she do that? Would she ask Diana to just go back to just before she died? Or is she asking Diana to not let her die? Like, there's a lot in there. I don't know exactly what she's asking, except to use that power. So yeah, I think what Sarah asks, I totally see how it could go either way. But I would be very surprised, not if anybody, because there are people out there who are gonna get it right away. I'd be interested in finding out what, like, I'm gonna do a poll or something. I'd be interested to know when someone watches, a fan watches this the first time through, what did they think? What was their first thought? What you just said, what the question you asked me, what did you first think Sarah was asking of Diana? Because yes, I thought it was high magic.
Because it was total misdirection for me. Because when they just started the scene talking very deeply into how she was back into black dark magic and how bad that higher magic is and how this, that, and the other, and M never did it and only knew because of experience, you know, all of that. And then all of a sudden she goes and she goes, but you can. And I was like, is she really going to ask her to do the same things that M wanted to do? And then she said, Diana immediately understood her to be saying time travel.
Yeah. Diana / Teresa knows the writer.
Well,
she was in the reading
room.
Knows
the writer, but it's like, I know. But all of the talk about the higher magic made me think that we were still on that subject.
Yes. I don't think it was a potential misdirect. I don't think they were trying to misdirect us. I think it's natural to make the assumption that out of desperation, and it makes more sense because what she was telling M before M died was, you can't do this. And yet after M dies, it would be almost poetic, not beautiful and not great, not undangerous. It's still dangerous, but it would be understandable and very human, right? Of her to say, look, I know she was doing this and she knew better, but can we please try? I'm like, could we find out. So yeah, I think, of course, wouldn't you give anything if you lost the person who meant the most to you in the world? Wouldn't you almost give anything to find whatever, I don't know what she wanted, to find out something or to save her? Come on. I think that makes actually more sense than time travel, because it was about the page. We're talking about the page. If Sarah meant to change it, to bring her back or to have her not die, then yeah, that would be time travel, because I don't think you can do... You cannot resurrect, that I know of, yet. But if you're a time walker, you could go back and somehow maybe prevent something. So yeah, it makes sense, but it definitely was confusing to me. I did not go to time travel first. Of course, Diana says no. She's like, girl, no. I am not disappointed. I mean, sorry. Okay. I'm disappointed. I'm not angry. Again, books and series are separate, but and maybe they couldn't have done this, at least in the first episode, so it may still come, but maybe they couldn't have done this because of the way they chose to open the show, right? They opened the show with M barely clinging on to life, and then she dies. So what I'm about to say literally could not have happened at the beginning of the episode, and we know it didn't happen throughout episode one, but maybe it's to come. If I remember correctly, part of or early on in book three, it opens as Diana, well, even before we see Diana coming up, right? I don't think Diana sees anything. But the book, early on, there's a conversation between the ghost of Emily Mather and Philippe.
Yeah.
And I was disappointed that we didn't see that, because that would have made me bawl my eyes out.
Well, see, now, I personally think they're just trying to hold some cards to their chest at this point. But also, I thought of another scene in this episode where she absolutely belongs to be in. And we could talk about that when we get to it.
Oh, the ghost?
Yeah. In this episode.
Ah. Oh, where's that?
I'll tell you when we get there.
Oh, okay.
Let's build some suspense.
So after she asks her to do not higher magic, but actual time travel. And Diana's like, Sarah, you know we can't do this. She lets her know, surprise, it's twins. But Sarah isn't in the mindset right now to take too kindly to anything. She's not anti anything, but part of her reaction, as she says later on when she apologizes, she was lashing out because not only was she like crazy, she's still like the whole episode, probably the whole, not the episode, her whole life she'll be in mourning, but definitely during the series, right? For the rest of the season, she's in the deepest mourning. She's missing the love of her life, her soulmate, and she's, out of desperation, has asked Diana something, and Diana has said, like, no, you know, we can't do that. Or no, I won't do that. I can't change things like that. And even though she knows better, she knew it. She did it because she's desperate. We understand that. And she's not truly angry at Diana. She knows it's the right answer, but it's another little thing. She's just lost Emily, right? Diana's no, even though she knew it was going to be a no, was another, pardon the pun, nail in that coffin, or another finger. She's trying to hold on to M, the memory of M, and the presence of M, the humanity. I know she's a witch, I know, but physicality of M. And it's like slowly, like her, like two hands being held as you go further and further apart. You like drop one finger, then another finger, then you touch less and less and less. And Diana saying, no, we cannot do that, was maybe not the final let go of that, but it was like she lost another finger, or they got, you know, maybe 2 more inches or another foot apart. I don't know. So because of her hurt, she lashed out. And Sarah says, you know, what are they going to be? What are they going to be? Not what are you having? Not how are you feeling? Not when did this happen? Not congratulations. But again, we totally understand that it's not, Sarah's not in the mindset yet. And it totally shocked her.
She's not in the receiving mood right now.
She's not in the giving mood.
Well, but you have to imagine her stress cup is real full.
Yeah, of course.
So adding extra stress to that when it's already full is going to lead to giant explosions.
I don't think a pregnancy announcement is adding stress, but it's not helping or hurting.
I think that it is, because in that moment, she's thinking, great, now there's something, two more things I have to worry about. Two more people, you know, now I've got to worry about what is in Diana. Now I've also got to worry about whether or not, you know, they're going to get killed by somebody.
I don't think she's upset or disappointed, whatever, about having to worry about what Diana is carrying. Her choice of words was very specific. Like, what are you having? I know they're creatures and they're not humans, but we speak of humanity, right? Or creatureness. I don't know, whatever you want to call it. A basic humanity of, or the dignity, I guess, is the best way to put it. All creatures and humans would share. The fact that she says what, even though technically it may not be humans. What do you say? You don't say who, because, I mean, I guess you could say who, but that who implies personality or identity, which I guess a witch could be. But anyhoozle, as I said, I think her lashing out, her saying, we don't even know what they're going to be. You know, the choice of words, her saying what, I don't think that was out of stress or it was definitely out of stress. I mean, obviously she's hurting, but I think it was more out of Diana just told her no. And she's losing more and
maybe
more.
They're all hand in hand.
Oh, of course. But I think it's more out of, I don't know. I just don't see babies being stress on her yet, or the knowledge of babies being a stressor. Yet. I mean, it could be, but that's not how I saw it, but it could definitely be. Then we're in Venice. Agatha et al. Arrive at congregation headquarters, and Agatha gives stink eye to Knox. She gives a great stink eye, or stink face. They are meeting, we find out, at the request of Agatha. But she like stands up to start, because I think it was Baldwin or Joubert. Someone said,
I completely forgot about the recast when this started. And I was like, who's that guy? Why is he important now? And I was like, oh God, it's Baldwin. It's a different Baldwin. This Baldwin is not as feral.
I would definitely agree.
As the other Baldwin.
And part of that is not just his acting. His acting is fine. He does not look.
It's the actor.
Exactly. He does not look as feral as the other guy did. So I don't know if it's Baldwin. I forget if it was Baldwin or Joubert. I'm thinking Baldwin, but someone...
Baldwin.
So Baldwin announces, we are here because it was requested by Agatha. And she was literally about to stand up. Or she was standing up and about to speak. And before they let her speak, the vamps are like completely taking over the conversation. They're like, okay, before we get to that, which is the reason we're all here, we need to talk about this whole blood rage thing going on in London. Something's going on. And Joubert brings up the mixing. So that leads into the blood rage, obviously. And Joubert brings up the mixing and mating of different creatures. He mentions, he brings this, you know, he has a goal here, right? He brings it to Diana and Matthew are now married. And then Agatha's like, look, yo, I call this meeting. Y'all have taken my platform. I am now going to take it back. Y'all shut up. So she takes the stage. She takes the platform. She's like, okay, this is why I'm here. Peter Knox, he killed Emily Mather. And Knox says, whoa, no. And he full on victim blames. She shouldn't have been doing this. She was doing this magic. And you know what? I can't help if she got in trouble. What about Marcus? Oh, he there too. She was doing higher magic. It's not my bad. So she moves that Knox be removed from the congregation for his crimes. And then Gerbert's like, yeah, that's great and all, but, you know, someone would need a second. And Baldwin's like, me. Mm-hmm. He doesn't waste any time. And then, of course, they need the votes. And the votes, Satu became our homegirl this episode. So she helped that along. Yes, Nox is removed. And boom, this is his unleashing. If we thought, and I don't, this is not a spoiler because I'm not going to say what happens. I think it's, and they allude to it all over this episode or toward the end of the episode. This is not news. As dangerous as Peter Nox was before, he is completely unleashed now because he has lost his standing. He has lost any support, right? He has lost his importance.
We almost got a tantrum.
Right?
Because he was like, nah, nah, nah. And then somebody else talked and he's like, fine, I'm going to put my decorum together and I'll leave. But he was ready to throw down.
And Satu, there. If you look at her, she's very careful about it, but she looks very carefully happy.
She's the cat who ate the canary.
Oh, that made me laugh.
She's like, you know, it's just my nature. You know, I didn't make you do that, but I'm absolutely going to do what I do now. Like,
yep. And then she's like, well, she actually says the truth. She's like, you killed a witch. You cannot be here. Like, this is, that's beyond. Mm-hmm. That's beyond. So they finish at the congregation. Agatha takes like a side room or a side hallway. I don't know. But she calls Nathaniel and she tells him about Nox. And she's like, look, she basically confirms exactly what I said, right? She's like, look, this is my words, not hers. You got to be careful. He's unleashed. There is nothing, nothing that will protect you. And
she's like, I can't protect you. Is like, even correct. Anything. She's like, to the fact that you need to not tell me where you're going. If I know where you are, you're in peril. Yeah.
Yes. You need to get away. We have to go no contact because if I know where you are and some shiz comes to shove and he does a mind F on me, I will let him know. I will tell him. I will not be able to keep that. So I need to not know until all of this is over. So that was very sad. That was very sad because Agatha. I love that character. Oof. Back to Sarah and Diana. They go to the temple for M's, I wanted to say funeral, but service? I don't know.
You know what caught me about this scene is the first time I watched it, I was like, what is going on with her hood? Hair doesn't come out from underneath a hood.
And no one else has one on.
But when then they went side and got her from the side, I was like, oh, it's a scarf.
Oh, I couldn't tell.
They've wrapped a scarf around her head and shoulder. And
I do like that. It did, but it.
Right. But it looked like a hood. So I was like, why is her? I was like, I guess I've forgotten how hoods work because I don't think your hair comes out the bottom of it.
Sarah tells Diana before they go into the circle. She's like, I don't think I can do it. Or they go to the circle and she tries to give Sarah this thing or whatever. Or Sarah's holding it and Sarah says, I don't think I can do this. So she takes it from Sarah. She goes in to the circle next to the, I'm guessing the body where it's laid out on this table and begins the ceremony. And at a certain point, she falters in her speech. And then Sarah comes and they do it together. So that was very beautiful. And under this scene, it's not loud. It shouldn't be loud. Nothing should be loud here. Under this scene, there's a hint. I'm losing my voice now, girlfriend.
Stop it.
Under this scene, there's a hint of the theme. It's as I always say, it's beautiful and sad. It's beautiful. I love this theme. It's so, it can do a lot of things.
This is the scene that I wanted Em and Philippe to show up at.
That's what I wanted them to show up. Like they am standing like kind of outside the circle.
Yeah.
Oh, from out, like looking in from outside. Oh, mm-hmm. Shit. F my mother. No, don't F my mother.
Wow. I'm going to tell mom.
No, you better not. Anyhoozle, that would have been so nice there. That would have made up for them not being obviously there, obviously at the beginning, but that's fine. We still may get them. I know, but that was opportunity lost. Very, very beautiful. Back at set tour, Isabeau says to Mart that she doesn't feel or didn't feel right attending the funeral given her history. And I wrote, and that's on respect.
I love that character so much.
Me too.
Just because she's fascinating. Like the choices she makes, the way she goes about doing the things she does it there. It's fascinating. And then, you know, she'll do something like this because when you first introduced to her, you're like, there's no way. There's no way this lady is ever going to warm to anybody else or care about a witch. You know, there's no way. There's no way. And then for her to be seeing firsthand that everything she's thought for her whole life was not true and the grace of kind of moving into her new reality.
And being going from the killer of witches, the hunter of witches, to not only the mother-in-law of a witch, but the blood grandmother of, we don't know what yet, but of a witch's, But no, the blood grandmother of a witch's two children. So yeah, she's got a fascinating history and story. So Em apologizes after the funeral. She apologizes to Diana about the twins comment and then pops out a page of the book that she had found in the temple. She had kept it and she gave it to Diana. And Diana pledges to make Knox pay. And then suddenly, or not so suddenly, Baldwin stops by. He's like, where have you been? And Matthew's like, oh, we've been in London for a few months.
I mean, they were.
Baldwin tells Matthew that Knox was removed from the congregation. And they have some words regarding to whom Diana answers in this family. I'm like, that's great. He tells Matthew, you need to kill the blood rage vampire. And then it's time for a family dinner. And he goes, oh, do bring the witch. They just can't even use her name. Now, something I thought I took a note on, but I didn't. So something I meant to take a note on was when he mentions Philippe's blood vow. Baldwin's like, I'll believe it when I see it.
Because it was total misdirection for me, which meant that I wanted the scene where he finds it the first time.
I know. I bet they had so, to. I wonder if that's a continuity thing. It doesn't hurt us to have that. It's not wrong. They don't have anything in there that contradicts it themselves. However, by taking out the actual scene, if indeed they had it, by taking out that scene and editing, it's not giving us that great little morsel. But yeah, I can't imagine they wouldn't have filmed that because how awesome would that have been?
That's what I'm saying. It was just a missed opportunity. Like, we're all still getting used to Baldwin anyway.
Like, so for real, like, because it's a new Baldwin.
Right. And he's just, he has different characterizations, different things he does. Like, he's quieter. Now, he still yells, but he seems to act more like a businessman, which is, I think, honestly true to the book, but a businessman who sits in board meetings all day. But the way that the previous Baldwin played him, the demon underneath was always near the surface, whereas this one doesn't seem to have that same core.
I thought one of the funniest, even though we don't get a lot of it, I thought one of the funniest things of the entire episode is there were two dinners going on. There was a family dinner and a non-family dinner.
A little Downton Abbey for
and
us.
And Miriam says, and we don't get very many lines, but we get enough time for Miriam to say, I know where I'd rather be.
I know, but you know who wasn't there?
Who?
Phoebe.
So Phoebe was nowhere?
Phoebe was not at dinner. Like, I watched it again and I was like, no, everyone but Phoebe. So I don't know why.
Oh, so
I don't
she
know
was
where
not,
she would be.
She wasn't even with, oh, so she must have, maybe they, I don't know. That's weird. I did not notice that. So back at the family dinner, Baldwin doesn't like being questioned by Diana at all. Mm-mm. And Diana mentions that for many other creatures, the covenant has outlived its use. And Baldwin loses it. Back at the non-family dinner, they all drink to M. Back at the family dinner, they drink to Diana and the twins. So that's, I did not notice, even though I wrote that, I did not reflect on what I wrote. I'm just taking notes as I typing really fast as I watch.
Mm-hmm.
Not only you have this, I want to say quite duality. It's not that, you know, huge of a thing, but it's two different dinners, two different populations, in family, out family. Out family is not a thing, but, you know, family, non-family.
Well, just like family and then outsiders. Like, they're like, you're not
there
really
you go.
Family.
It's like insiders and outsiders. That's a better way of looking at it. The outsiders drink to the one they've lost. And the insiders drink to the ones who are coming.
Yeah, but nobody really drank to it because it was a bad toast.
I don't think either toast is bad, but it's interesting the differences. And it makes sense because Diana was not there in the room with them, right? At the non-family dinner, at the outsiders dinner. So yeah, it makes sense that they're not drinking to the twins because it's not that they have no ill will toward the twins, but they're outsiders. So, and M would have been there. M would have been an outsider. So it does make sense. It is in that way, it is a little bit of upstairs, downstairs, Downton Abbey. So at the family dinner, as I said, they drink to Diana and the twins. And then Baldwin says it, right?
Nobody drinks to the babies.
No. What Baldwin says, he says, whatever they are.
I know, but I'm saying nobody drinks to the babies. Like, they all sit their glasses down. Nobody does it. He ruins the toast.
I think Baldwin says that this is not the first time a vampire has had a child with a witch. And we don't get a ton of detail, but someone, I think, I don't know if Diana or someone asked what happened to them. And the witches banished, if I understood correctly, the witches banished the child. I'm not talking about what we know from the book. I'm talking about what they said in the show. So I could have misconstrued that, but that's what I believe I heard. And then Baldwin says, anyone who is not a de Clermont should leave Septour by morning. That's a mighty howdy doody there. Later, Matthew tells Diana about Benjamin's creation or how he was created. He was one. So Benjamin was a human that he and others thought they could trust. But when he proved he could not be trusted, Diana remembers meeting him in Bohemia. And he said he called himself Fuchs. And Matthew's like, that's impossible. And she's like, no, I think, you know, he could smell the blood vow. I think it was him.
Does she really think there's only one vampire named Benjamin?
Benjamin?
In like the entire world in the 1700s or the 1600s, whenever they were? Like the odds.
She or him?
Diana, assuming that just because she met a vampire named Benjamin.
Oh, it's the same guy?
In the past, that it's the same vampires. Like, is there only allowed to be one Ben at a time?
You have to ask Diana. I do not know. Matthew does not. I think Diana says, yeah, I think she uses the word your son. And Matthew's like, uh-uh. He is not my son in any way that matters. He says he made him a vampire. As I said earlier, he was someone that many believed could be trusted. When he proved himself to be untrustworthy, he made him into a vampire. And he knew that would give him the blood rage. And so he did that so that if he outed them, he outed himself at that point. So after created him, he abandoned him, quote, a new blood rage vampire, unquote. And he expected him to eventually die or be killed, quote, it was the most terrible miscalculation. You think?
No, but.
So Glasgow's smoking some Galois and meets Marcus. And here is, again, so much happens in this episode. They talk about starting a scion. Actually, Glasgow mentions it.
Like, they introduced that really quickly into this book, into this show, I should
say. Hecka quick.
But then because of the length of the book, I don't believe there was this much pushback in the book.
To the scion?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, let's get there first. So in the next scene with everybody around the table, Marcus tells us what a scion is. Quote, any male with full-blooded children can establish a scion, which would be a branch of the original family, but with autonomy, unquote.
Welcome to exposition.
Yes. And he says they could take people with them, meaning if you're from, even if you're not part of the blood family, you could join the scion. If they establish a scion, they can establish their own path, which means they could have power and organization, which is accepted. Because again, scions are allowed. They could have power and they could establish their own path and they'd have their own organization and be able to take on. Basically, it's a substitute for the congregation because everyone's saying, the congregation, if we go against them, if we do this, if we do that, Well, the answer may very well be to form a scion, which is a new, not a congregation, but a new type of group, right? Type of family, type of organization. Matthew says no. He says, we have enough problems without splitting the family. The next morning, people are leaving Septour. They're off to London town. Baldwin tells Isabeau that if Matthew crosses the line, he's not going to protect him. Again, it's not going to happen. He's not going to protect him. It's his own ass on the line now. So Isabeau is staying at Septour because that's girlfriend's home. That is her seat.
Well, I just want to know how Galglass is going to ride his motorcycle. He left it there.
Well, he'll probably get another one. But yeah, that would be.
You made such an entrance. Now you're getting in a helicopter?
In London, a car with Matthew, Diana, and Sarah, if I'm not mistaken, stop in front of a house, an attached house, and we meet Fernando. He's one.
But whenever I think of him, I always hear the ABBA song. Do you hear the drums, Fernando? You'd have to know the song.
See, if I was very familiar with that. No. It's just like when we talk about Jamie's mother, Ellen. I want to say, her name was my name is Ellen. That may have been the wrong interval. But anyway, if I had known of that song or been really, really familiar with that song, I probably would have gone to that too. But I don't. I didn't. So I won't. And I don't. And so you do. So that's good.
Wow.
That was a lot. I know. Didn't really make a lot of
words.
Sense. A lot of, oh, hella words. I got words. If you ever need words, I got words. So who was Fernando? More exposition, right? So we learn some from Matthew and later on some from Fernando. So here it's from Matthew. He was the mate of Hugh, the eldest son of Philippe. Then we have Sarah and Diana, of course. Now Matthew wants to extract DNA from that missing page that shown up now. And he wants to do so to understand the blood rage. They need to find a discreet lab. And the next scene, we get a location on the screen that says South Kensington, London. And we meet Diana's university chum, Chris. Correct me if I'm wrong, but in the book, Chris was not in London.
Yale.
So they definitely brought him to the UK, which, again, makes it so much easier. We get it. That's cool. Just a change. But I wanted to make sure I was not misremembering. Like, how convenient is that? Yeah, well, it's a show. They have less time. So Miriam gives his lab a once-over, and they slowly let Chris know about their research. Then, back with Fernando, we see that Sarah has stayed with Fernando. He's babysitting Sarah. Oh, gosh. Protecting her, too, but also kind of babysitting. And she wants to talk about M. Sarah scoffs when Fernando asks about Hugh. Like, do you know about Hugh? So from Fernando, we get more about Hugh. Hugh was Philippe's eldest son, and they were mated for 6 centuries. Philippe refused to recognize their union. So when Hugh died, neither Fernando's loss nor his grief were acknowledged either. And we find out Hugh's been gone for 700 years. So when I first watched the scene, I thought it was a beautiful scene. I thought it was sad. I thought it was great the way that we met Fernando and see the scene with him and M. But I didn't remember. I don't know if this scene happens in the book. I couldn't tell you. But either way, the way this is in the show is beautiful. And on my first watch, I just, again, was watching it for information, right? Watching it to experience it. It's a very purposeful. It's a very purposeful scene. Very purposeful, right? They chose this moment or this way to introduce Fernando.
The conversation absolutely happens in the book, but it might not have happened here, but they do in the book have Fernando and Sarah kind of healing each other.
So what I was trying to say was this scene is beautiful. Not only great because we learn more about Fernando, but the fact that they are equals here. They're equals here. And Fernando is letting her know, literally, I've been there. He intimately understands both her general grief that you've lost someone you love, as well as your particular grief that you've lost someone you love who was part of a same-sex relationship that may or may not, you know, depending on the time in history, place in history, et cetera, be acknowledged or legal. Right. But he also tells her that she is fortunate. These are my words, not his. But she is fortunate that her loss is recognized and accepted. So Fernando is probably the only person in the entire cast. Right. The only character that we have of Deb's who could absolutely know what M is feeling as far as the grief and the loss. But he's also the only person who probably could have made her, I don't want to say feel better because we don't know that she felt better after this, but at least let her see that in as much grief as she is in, the fact that she can openly, maybe not as a witch, right? But as a partner, she can openly mourn and people will join her in that mourning and feel for her and come around her and mourn with her is a gift. And he says that he lives in hope that his grief may also be recognized. So that tells us that it hasn't been, which is awful.
I mean, it definitely hasn't been by the people he wants it to be done by. Because Matthew absolutely has no problem with that and supports him in that. So it's not that Gallowglass, now granted, he's not, they are not the vampires he needs the acceptance from in his heart, is all I'm saying.
Then we go to Chris's state-of-the-art lab, apparently, which is in Vampires and Demons. Oh my, he's like, you guys got to, like, what do you want me to do? What are you into? What are you got? What's your research? Blah, blah, blah. And they try to explain it. And he's like, yeah, that's kind of sus. I don't know. Yeah, right.
Well, he's just like snarky about it. And he's like, yeah, sure. How am I supposed to know that? And I thought she was really restrained.
Hella restrained. She could have gone, do you remember last year? You remember last season? Which wasn't last year. You remember last season? That one episode where she like sets the room on fire? Yeah, she's restrained.
Or she hatched a chicken.
Oh, yeah, but a chicken wouldn't kill somebody. No. And that's it's impressive, but it's not dramatic. I mean, it is. It's dramatic, but it's not dangerous.
Even in season one where she pulled a bow and arrow out of fire.
Yeah, that would have been dramatic and impressive and dangerous too. So she goes, she does a little water witchy. And when she's like, oh, okay, fine. Tell me what I need to know. Matthew explains the creatures and that they're on the decline and also the need for a cure for blood rage.
He's like, no big deal. It's a short list. You should be able to take care of that pretty easily. The water scene made me think about the abyss.
Oh, that's very good. I did not, but that I can absolutely see that. That was the abyss is, I think, is kind of an underrated movie. It was such a good movie. It was so sad. It was
beautiful
so
movie.
Good. Oh no, it was beautiful. It was freaking creepy, right? It was hella creepy.
Oh, yeah.
But it was scary and beautiful and dramatic and oh, so good. I love that movie. Woo.
Well, it was like all the feelings while also being a suspenseful kind of horror movie.
All of it, which you don't get a ton of. It had, okay, I'm going to make a comparison. And you're going to go like, huh? But the fact that you said horror and beautiful and suspense and also sadness and all those things, I think you of all people will understand this when I say, can you guess what movie or series I'm thinking of?
Is this a TV show or a movie?
It's a series.
It literally just floated out of my head. I had an idea and then it floated out of my head. No, just tell me.
The Haunting of Hill House.
Oh, no, that was not where my brain was going. But yes, I can see that.
Bly Manor?
Well, when you say horror, I think about the horror that you don't watch. And so I was like, well,
it's zombie?
Right. And you don't like demons and you don't like.
Why would I ever bring up zombies?
I'm just saying you only like specific horror. So I was trying to.
You were trying to filter out.
And I know you don't like paranormal stuff where you see ghosts and stuff and demons. So I was trying to, I don't know. I
so
was
you
like,
had a lot harder word than I did.
I did. I was like, is it, I'm like, maybe True Blood? No.
Oh, maybe, gosh.
Maybe Twilight?
Summer. Dear listener, if that whole thing was like, what the hell are you guys talking about? I was trying to make a comparison between The Abyss, not the content and not where it's, not the location, like none of the actual facts of it, right? None of the settings or anything, none of the characters, but the genre-ish type, I guess. All the adjectives Summer and I used, both separately, I believe can describe The Abyss and also describe The Haunting of Hill House. Anyway, that's why I said that. So if you haven't seen it, please go watch it. It's on Netflix. It's so good. It's a little bit jump scary, a little bit, which I don't love, but I watch in the daylight and have all the windows open and lots of light and you'll be fine if you're like me.
I would just like to say thank you for bringing Fernando onto the show so that I could finally remember Domenico's name.
Oh, yes. You got that mixed up. That's right.
Oh, gosh. Frederico and
Frederico.
But now that I have a Fernando, I will have a clear space for Domenico.
So yeah, Matthew's like, or we need this and we need that. So please go to town. And then the next scene, Baldwin meets Domenico and gets photos. Domenico's delivering photos from the crime scenes and victims of the blood rage vampire who's on the loose in London. And he says the same person who did this, the killer, stole portraits from the 16th century from that, not the museum, but the
auction house.
The auction house. And he's like, that's the only thing they stole. That's it. There's nothing else. So it was very specific. It was, they wanted them. He or she, the vampire wanted only those things. And so he's feeding in some intel. Domenico, this is my words, nobody else's. Domenico is on his own side. He right now is helping Baldwin. But as Domenico, as he said earlier in this episode, he was fighting for his life with that blood-raged vampire. So he wants that vampire dead more than just as much as anyone.
He wants to say not it. He's like, not it, you take it, I'm out, I almost died.
Yeah, he's like, I'm giving this to you, please do your job or do the job, and just I'll help you out in this instance, I'm helping you out. But he's on his own side. But he's also a mensch. Or sorry, he can be a mensch, I guess is better to say.
If it benefits him, he will do it. And sometimes that means making a good decision that helps the good people out, as opposed to just aligning with the dark all the time.
And then we go to the next to last scene. We get Benjamin Fuchs is on the phone.
You know what?
I texted Summer. The actor who plays Benjamin Fuchs is freaking hot. I'm sorry.
Here's what I need to say. Because we barely saw Benjamin Fuchs last season, and he was in period clothing and period facial hair and all those things. I did not recognize this actor at first because I was thinking, there's a, spoiler alert from the book that there's another character from that time period who's going to be popping up. And I didn't know what that person's going to look like either. So I was like, is it him? And so I watched the entire episode the first time thinking it was a completely different character. And then I went back and I was like, oh no, that's Benjamin. But I didn't even totally connect the dot that it was Benjamin until I watched the scenes from next week's episode.
So he's hot, is what you're saying.
I believe you, but I'm just saying I did not notice him last season.
You believe it. I believe it. And Benjamin gets a call. He picks up the phone. So I immediately thought both watches. So the first time as a fangirl, and the second time as a podcaster/note taker. Both times I thought someone's calling him and giving him information. And both times I thought the same thing. I wonder if that was Knox.
Maybe.
Because the question, and I'm not saying that because we have foreknowledge, because yes, we've read the books. The reason I thought Knox was because someone, we don't hear the words, but Fuchs's response was, or basically what he was told was that they've left or they're on their way. So as he leaves the hotel room, we find out that he's in a hotel room. The camera stays on a laptop. He just leaves there. And the page he has up has a picture of Diana on it. So he's obviously still looking for them, right? And we know he's in Germany because he speaks German, or at least the maid service speaks German to him. And he's leaving his hotel room. He leaves the door open. And as we leave, we see the carnage behind, a little bit of it. And as she sees it and screams, he smiles as he's walking out. And the very last scene or very last shot we get is that Baldwin is looking over pictures from the various
murders,
crime scenes or attacks, and the victims. Yeah.
And that was episode 1 of season 3. Join us next time when we will be discussing episode 2.
Thank you as always so much for listening. We are so happy to be back. Thanks so much for listening.